everybody. I'm here with Dr. Laura Halfstead. She's a clinical psychologist and has been practicing in Sonoma County, California since 1980. She obtained her PhD from the University of Southern California, and her approach to therapy is rooted in Bowen theory, which she studied directly from the pioneer, Dr. Murray Bowen, at the Georgetown Family Center from 1976 to 1980. In 1989, she began the programs in Bowen theory in Northern California to teach and advance Bowen theory by sponsoring conferences and leading training seminars that are still going on. Her two areas of special interest are the development of a framework for clinical and family research based on Bowen theory, and Bowen theory is an integrative framework for the discipline of psychology. And more recently, she's been researching, thinking about the societal concept in Bowen theory, which we'll talk about today. She was married for 48 years and before her husband passed in 2021. And she's also a mother to three daughters and has four little grandsons that call her Bubby. And it's going to take everything in me to not call you Bubby. But I'm so glad you're here, Laura. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for your interest, Guillermo. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. Well, let's just get started with a little bit about you. Where did you grow up? Did you grow up in, I know you're in California now. Is that where you were born and raised? Or
I'm a native Californian. My parents' families immigrated from the Midwest and just before the Second World War, and I grew up in West Los Angeles.
What was West Los Angeles like in at that time?
Well, you know, we were in a little subdivision that was built after the war, and a lot of families moved in on the GI Bill, as did my family. And down the block, you know, there was a celery field. And there were streetcars, electric cars that took people like my father, who worked downtown. He would get on a streetcar and travel downtown, which was, I don't know how long that trip took, but it was, you know, now driving on the freeway, it's a good 20, 25 minutes away. So it was a distance on regular streets. But it was a very safe place. You know, we grew up playing in the streets. We had a lot of friends on the block that we lived on. My family was sort of upwardly striving, and we moved north of Sunset when I entered into junior high school. And the city was free enough that as a youngster of 12, 13, 14, 15, I was riding bikes with my friends all over the city. And, you know, with one of my little friends after school, we'd get on the bus and all the way down to Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard for ballet lessons by ourselves on the bus. You know, things that parents don't think of doing anymore. So it was a good place to grow up. Very creative community as well. So yeah.
What was creative in what, the creative people, arts?
Well, it was the early days, you know, it was Hollywood and all the creative people, the writers, the directors, the artists that ever were associated. I think that was probably the main thing.
Did you do ballet for a while?
Yeah, I did. I did it until I was about 13 or 14. I was not really built to be a ballet dancer, but my best friend went on to found a ballet company and direct a school. And one of her students is now a principal at the New York City Ballet. So she's had, and that was, she was an example of coming from one of the creative families where the grandparents were screenwriters in early Hollywood with writing scripts for the Marx Brothers and the Elizabeth Taylor's Little Women and her mother's godmother was Mary Pickford. So a lot of stuff like that.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
When you were playing on the streets in your neighborhood growing up, what were you playing?
Horses, we'd set up things where we would jump. As little girls, we all kind of, a few of us really loved horses. Jacks, we had board games. Candyland, I think, was one that was a
Oh.
good one. Roller skates, bicycles. We got a little more mischievous sometimes as we got older. And would, I don't know, do things to sort of disturb neighbors and, which is interesting to think back on. I'm still good friends with those little girls I grew up with and from the playpen on.
Wow.
Yeah, we meet regularly. So,
That's amazing.
yeah.
As you guys stayed friends all these years, you know.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
Yeah, you know, playing horses. My mom played horses when she was a kid. She tells me stories about her and her sister doing it out in the orange groves of Florida, you know.
Yeah, that's one
So,
thing California and Florida really have in common are the orange groves.
yeah.
Southern California.
Did you have any siblings growing up?
Yeah, I have two younger brothers. I have their fraternal twins. They were 2.5 years younger than me.
So are you a traditional oldest? This the responsible one, this type of thing?
I guess. I think so. But I never had to be overly responsible. Both my brothers are very good functioning people. They've been quite accomplished in their lives with their families and the work that they do and have done. One of my brothers was a state senator in New Mexico.
Oh, wow.
He came in with the Obama election against a 16-year Republican incumbent, 2008, 4 years after moving there, which was, he's always kind of amazed us. And my other brother was, both of them were quite successful businessmen. And so in that sense, I didn't have to be an over responsible oldest for them. I was more over responsible for my father, I would say, who was also quite a successful man. But up against my mom, it was tough. So I carried his flag, and one of the actually my first in-person contact with Murray Bowen was at this conference in Los Angeles. I was in graduate school, and I went to see him, and I had actually written him. After reading the anonymous paper, it was kind of extremely taken by that. Well, like, if that's what I need to know how to do is how to get outside the emotional system. And I had written him being out in California, is there anybody I can work with out here? Is there a scale of differentiation I could use for my doctoral research, which was like the question that he made quite fun of once I got into the training program. There was no instrument of scale of differentiation. So I went up to talk with him at the conference, and I don't remember exactly what led to this comment, but it was something about it, so often in families, the pattern is the distant father and the child in the close relationship with the active relationship with the mother. And I said to him, yeah, the thing with me though was I was trying to save my father. I was always trying to save my father. And he said, well, you did, didn't you? And it kind of totally shifted my perception of everything, just that like one comment. I all of a sudden, I had always felt unsuccessful in that role. And because I had to keep doing it over and over. And his perception in the moment just penetrated, and all of a sudden I saw that I had been sort of absorbing the some the impact, the cost that to me for being in that position, that enabled him to have a calmer relationship with my mother. Why that comment did that, but it just all of a sudden came clear to me. So that's maybe where the over-responsible oldest came in.
So you were in kind of your graduate, you were getting your psychology graduate degree, correct? When you found the anonymous papers? Can you, well, maybe if you could just give a little bit of a description of intro to what Bowen theory is, and then what struck you in these anonymous papers that made you reach out?
Well, I think it was like I said, it was the, to me, that paper, most simply said, demonstrated a successful effort to deal with an intense emotional set of situations in the family, and in that case, in Bowen's extended family, in which he used his understanding that the concept of triangles had just come together for him, and he used the concept of the triangle's relationship to plot a course through what he felt thought was predictable in order to get into an outside position. And his idea was basically, he wanted to interrupt what he thought might be a shockwave in his family. And his hypothesis was that if he could get into and outs to stay outside what he called the emotional system, which is the automatic emotional process in the family that goes on and on and on, in which the anxiety sort of lands in certain places, and those people and relationships it lands in are vulnerable to symptoms and breakdowns. So that was his idea going in, and he wrote this article up, and it was very funny, because he in staking out this outside position, it's when you do that, for those of you who've done that, people never understand what you're doing, really. They never do. And they have interesting ways of interpreting it. And then you have to have ways of not getting caught in arguing with them or reacting to them or losing your course of what you've set out to do. And if you can get what he called getting all the way through to the other side, which I think basically means when the tension really dies down on the other side of the tension field, where people can kind of come back into contact with each other in a person-to-person way. The family is a calmer, better differentiated organism.
When one person can get outside of it and stay a little more neutral in how they operate, that helps, is useful to the family.
When I read the anonymous paper, it wasn't like a little more neutral. It was like way different.
So operating a lot differently than you are when you're caught up in it.
I mean, I think that little bit more neutral is important in the steps along the way. But when you really get outside of it, it's a transcendental experience.
To really be outside of it. I think that's one thing Bowen theory offers that is different than other theories. This idea that the family is the emotional unit.
Yeah, I think so. And it's a stumper. How do you put that into effect? You can read the anonymous paper. I've read it every few years since I first read it. It's probably about time for me to read it again, but it took me a very long time to understand it. It had this real wallop of an emotional impact of just recognition, like, ooh, there's a way different way to be here. It works better for oneself and for everybody else. And that's so appealing that it's not a zero-sum game where someone wins and someone loses.
It's not, you can be totally different and still be connected to to the family, to the system.
Right.
Yeah, that's such a yeah, that is a, I could see how that is a transcendental shift. This experience, it's so hard to imagine being different in it sometimes.
Yeah, it's, after, so I started, well, yeah, I mean, I think I read the papers. It was 1974, 75, and when in 76, I started the postgraduate program in 76. So how many decades have I been at it? I've been teaching it. I've been, thinking about it every day. It was the basis of my practice. I was fortunate enough to, have that at the beginning for my practice. And when I am caught in the emotional system, which is frequent, seeing it a different way, I can't do it. I can't do it until I get a little out of it. So I have more faith that I can get there now than I used to.
I hear you. I
Mostly
do.
in small ways, So.
More is the faith like more confidence part of that?
Yeah.
That capable?
Yeah, it's experience. I kind of, I think a big part of it is it just to know, all those horrible feelings that come with being stuck in a spot you don't want to be in or being afraid of something. just knowing not to let that win the day. And that hanging in there, trying to think, trying to calm down, give it a little time. So, people talk about consulting their deceased spouses after they died for advice, and I do that, especially around stuff that comes up with the kids and where I'm going, like, I don't know what I'm going to do. What am I going to do here? The answer, when I kind of reflect on, sort of think about my husband and what he might have said, would have been. So the answer that always comes back is something like, you'll think of something. And I have that kind of confidence,
When you when you first reached out to Bowen, started working on understanding the theory, where did you get what was it in your own life that got you started, that you were like, I'm gonna poke at this a little bit?
Well, it really was that original triangle I was in with my parents. And I mean, I think, most of us who become clinicians have some pro family problem we're trying to solve. And I happened to maybe be fortunate in sort of understanding pretty clearly what it was I was trying to figure out. And along with it being the time of my life of trying to find my way, my orientation. I was 26 when I began studying at the Bowen Center. And so I think that was it. And honestly, Guillermo, once I found Bowen, like nothing else was as interesting to me. It, so it wasn't something I decided so much. It was something that just kind of happened to
Grabbed you.
me. And I had the opportunity, I was fortunate to meet Bowen. He invited me into the postgraduate program. They didn't take people still in training programs, but there was something in our interaction. I had just tried detrialing something in my family and I kind of blew it up, and my mother wasn't talking to me. And I showed up at that conference and hadn't washed my hair for a while, and I think I just looked, and he looked at me and he said something like, "You don't look so good," or something. And I said, "Well, Dr. Bowen, I just tried to detriangle my family, and I think I kind of blew it up, and I could really use some help." He got kind of very still and serious, and he said, "Well," he said, "I admire your courage." And he told me about the postgraduate program. So myself and Andrea Sciarra were the two people in that cohort, along with Randy Frost and Dan Paprow. They maybe were a year or two ahead of us. Bob Noon, we were part of the same cohort. But Andrea and I got in as not fully qualified, sort of. We were grandfathered in by the man himself at that point. And that was the opportunity that I had and I took. So.
Interesting. Out of that time of the training program, what how did you decide to, that you wanted what you wanted to do next? You went to do your own practice, I think, right?
My husband's family was in Northern California. I was in graduate school at USC, and we had moved down there for me to do that program. And sort of the deal was, when I was finished, we would move back north. We had met at UC Davis, and which is in Northern California, and his family was there. So we moved. We kind of put a compass point on San Francisco. We ended up north of San Francisco. His family was about the same distance south of San Francisco. So we ended up in Sonoma County. We decided to, we bought a house. I got a job. It was kind of not like just, it was sort of like, this is where we want to live, and I'll figure out what I can do when I get there. And I got a job at the state hospital, my first job as a psychologist. And it was a state hospital for the developmentally disabled. They had previously called them the mentally retarded. And I met the local psychologist in the area. One took me into his practice as a psychological assistant. So that was sort of the beginning of my private practice. And then eventually one of them hired me for the faculty at in the family practice residency of the University of California at San Francisco. Had a family practice re residency up in our local community hospital, and I got onto that faculty as a behavioral science consultant for the young doctors, the family practice doctors. And in those days, there was a lot of interest in family medicine, in learning how to do family diagrams and how to think, really how to think about the patient as a member of a family. And there was an aspiration of those in that field to have the in a way to have the family as a patient, to do multiple generations of the family, to know every the people in your page, for a family, for all the people, the father, the mother, the grandmother, the children, to all be patients within a given doctor's practice was sort of an ideal that was aspired to. And I think the way the insurance and managed care fell out in the years subsequent to that really broke up that ideal. It barely exists anymore, but it did that. So.
When so there was a focus on the family at the time, and and Bowen in particular was seeing the family as the emotional unit. What does that mean?
Oh, it means there's this profound and deep attachments that functions at a biological level. And that the emotional life of members in a family, of the individual members, is always in part being regulated by their relationships with the others. And that the way the individual members of the family regulate themselves has an impact on how that family system works. Something like that.
Makes a lot of sense. Which brings me to a quote of yours that I found that I think would open up kind of a few areas to talk about. And I thought you said it so beautifully when I heard it. It's durable changes in symptoms follow sustained shifts in family relationships, which reduce the emotional load on the symptomatic one, which is usually followed by an increase in functioning. I just like this idea of durable changes too, not just changes, durable changes in symptoms follow sustained shifts in family relationships. What's the connection between symptoms and shifts in relationships?
You can think of the family as an emotional unit. I mean, this is another answer to that question of what does it mean that the family is a unit. Is that it? The family as a relationship system parses out, distributes what I was calling there the emotional load, which is, Bowen defined as anxiety, which he defined, a much broader way than, what is understood as clinical anxiety. But the family and its relationships is sort of directing where the worry goes, on whom it lands. And the triangle is a relationship pattern that almost doesn't do the triangle justice. Bowen called it the molecule of the emotional system. So the triangles operate in such a way that they're repetitive patterns. That is, who's on whose side, focused in a negative way, for instance, on who else, ends up with repetitive sequences where the same person ends up in the hot seat, the recipient of negative emotion. And why is it so hard for us to take negative emotion? I think about that a lot now. I hate it when people are upset with me or mad at me. And I felt like, this is in the scope of life nothing, but I don't like it. But
Me
so,
neither.
so when that you're when you're when you're a child or otherwise in a weaker position, and that happens to you repetitively, you can start to break down. Your own anxiety, your own emotional resources go to defending against that, to opposing it, to fighting it. Your life is kind of caught up with being in that position and managing the discomfort and insult that you feel. And it gets into your physiology enough, and you're going to have where your physiology might be weakest. We all have our weak links. You may end up with a symptom of one sort or another, emotional, physical, whatever. So that if you can get in there, this was the original idea Bowen had about family therapy. If you get in there and have a family change that pattern, when that pattern is really driving someone into the mat, if you could get a durable change in that pattern, that person can move out of that symptomatic state because the anxiety is no longer focused on them. They are no longer absorbing the anxiety. They are no longer carrying that emotional load. And as their anxiety goes down, they can think more clearly. They can make decisions. They can attend to other life tasks that need attending to, and their functioning is better.
So a triangle is, when we're talking about triangles, it's three people, and two people usually directing anxiety toward a third. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's the projection process. Other things can happen, which is they can pull in another one, a fourth. And the tension can be triangled through a large group that way, and maybe not land so resolutely on someone. So that can happen, but that two against one configuration is one of the basic patterns. And maybe the one that, you know, when that's triangled out, and then you've got everybody who's focused on one, so you've got the symptomatic one in the family, that's transferring that's the mechanism for transferring the emotional load.
Yeah. Could that focus on one person, I think sound like we were talking about it in a negative focus. Could it also be like a positive focus? Like we're worried about them, want them to be better. So we focus on them more.
Yeah. I still call that a negative focus whenever it's,
oh, okay.
Whenever it's, you know, I'm worried about you and I want you to do better. But I hear what you're saying. It comes out of love and concern. It's not malevolent. And usually not malevolent. It can be.
But that can do somebody in of that it's more about the intensity of it, the pressure of it.
Yeah, and it's the kind of, I would say, disrespect of it.
Like you can't function for yourself type of thing.
Yeah, it's like I don't have confidence in you. You know,
and then that person takes that on.
Yeah. And that's hard, you know, it's hard when you're a parent and you can see your child struggling to not be in that position and to not transfer anxiety. We all do it.
It's almost like a natural process to some degree that the anxieties get transferred.
Yeah, I mean, over the years, you know, around the network around Bowen theory, there was a fair amount of thinking that's gone into why does it have to be this way? You know, it serves some function. And I mean, one of the things it does is it does free some people up to function better in the unit. And they can then, you know, they then become very important to that unit in that highly functioning position. And I mean, you can notice there's a fair number of families, like a lot of the president's families, there'll be like one brother who's president and the other one who's a drunk, you know. You know? And there's a few of them in recent history like that, you know, I think. And I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration. My apology to those families, but you know, the overall systems in nature. I mean, Laurie Lasseter has written about this with the bacteria and the way they form the stalks. I forget what they're called, but there's so many systems when you begin to look at other animals and other lower forms, so-called lower forms of life, where within a colony, within a functional unit within that species, some are appearing to kind of sacrifice their own functioning or reproduction for the ability of the others to do that. And as a result, the colony or the unit goes ahead and survives and reproduces and goes on through multiple descendants and generations. So the system works that way. It's just that there are some casualties along the way.
So it's about adaptation over time.
Yeah. Right.
Survival.
Yep. It may be something intrinsic to life systems that we're attempting to modify, which to me I found a very interesting idea. And you know, just the kind of makes the idea of trying to change it kind of audacious. And it creates for me a lot of patience with myself and others as to why this is so hard to do.
Absolutely. That it's we're up against nature in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I
Yeah,
think
you can really be more forgiving with yourself. Patient with yourself.
it gives you room to go, okay, I'll think of something. I don't know now, but I'll think of something.
I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
How does we've been talking about anxiety. I know you made a Bowen theory makes a great distinction between acute and chronic anxiety. How do you think about the difference between those two things, their function in kind of what we're talking about, the emotional system?
Well, I think acute anxiety is just part, well, both are part of life, but the acute anxiety has to do with usually immediate threats and situations when it has to do with real alerting us to real threats. It's a vital signaling system that's part of our organism. And when we effectively address the threat, the acute anxiety resolves and goes away. And we're kind of all, I think, dealing with variations in our level of acute anxiety, you know, throughout the day, throughout the hour, throughout the week, throughout you know, it's just it's sort of something we're dealing with, like, oh, I forgot to do this, or oh my God, you know. I've got to pay attention to this now. I've been over here paying attention to this, and now this is going out of control. You know, just so we're, you know, it's just life. And then chronic anxiety has more to do with these basic relationship problems. It often has to do with what are imaginary threats, in the sense that so much of the chronic anxiety that drives these relationship patterns are things like, I don't want to upset my mother. I don't want to upset my daughter. I don't want to upset my spouse. So I'm going to kind of tiptoe around because I'm afraid of their being upset. And, I'm calling that an imaginary threat, because what really is the threat if the other one is upset? It's kind of like the old, children's rhyme, sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me, or something like that. So chronic anxiety runs on that level of fear, which is deeply programmed and very hard to change. It's like you've been a rat in a shock box where the experimenter, just turns on the electricity and it runs through you at random times, and you're kind of,
On edge,
you're on edge.
almost.
Yeah. And so that level of chronic anxiety has to do with the way the basic relationship patterns in the family work. And if you can get a shift in those basic patterns, you can get a shift in that level of chronic anxiety, and also to some extent, if an individual can just get their functioning level up above that patterned emotional system, to where an individual is confident enough that when it kicks up, it's known, understood, and there's confidence that they can think of something. So.
So the functioning up is kind of recognizing how this system, the patterns in it that get kicked off, being able to see that and my part in it, and then figuring something out that's a little different.
Yeah, and so much of it is. I think, Guillermo, just that sort of basic assumption you have that when this stuff kicks up, you're part of it. That's your basic assumption, rather than, I think, what tends to be more typical and more defensive in normal levels of functioning, which is it's the other people and what's wrong with them. To go like, okay, it's kicked up. I am reacting to this. I'm part of it. What am I going to do with my part of it? That's what you hang in there with. What am I going to do with myself? What
So hard
principle, what idea am I going to use to guide my decision making here?
to how do you work with people to help them get at that?
Oh, anyway, I can.
That's a great answer. Whatever door opens.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's kind of easy, and you just say it, and you just kind of plant your flag there and say, this is how I see it. If you like this, stick around. If not, somebody else will help you with a different way. Something like that. And then with others, it's you never get there. Never, ever get there.
I hear you.
And trying everything. So I don't know how. I think, in clinical practice, I really do It used to be a mantra when I was in the training programs. It's the way you think about the problem determines how you approach it. And if you really believe that, it's going to guide what you do. And a lot of that is in the lived moment. You don't know what you're going to do. You know what you think about the problem, and you just keep trying, and sometimes you make it.
Yeah. I always remember that quote. I think it's from Bowen. We've all inherited a lifetime of tribulation. You know, when you think you've know the way, do the best you can with it. I'm missing some stuff, but it's something like that.
Yeah, I know that one. Yeah.
You talked about, well, I know one of your interests is using Bowen theory as a framework for psychology, an integrative framework. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I'm kind of looking that back up. That's a project I haven't sort of attended too much in the recent past. And really, I think there's kind of a lot to it, but the basics of it are this, that there's this continuum of functioning, which is the scale of differentiation of self that Bowen defined. And that continuum from sort of automatic functioning, not self-regulated functioning, subject to the environment, the social, physical environment, to the highest level of functioning where one is in charge of self and oneself is guiding one's being. So that scale, that continuum, and all that underlies it in our evolutionary development as human beings, there's three different areas in which that continuum organizes, could possibly organize a lot of observations. And one is in evolution. And that has to do with the development, the evolutionary development of the emotional cognitive system, the brain, and how through evolution there is a increased complexity of processing that goes on, whereby more information can be integrated, and there's an opportunity for the organism to make a choice. There's learning that occurs. And that's up from the very sort of basic automatic functioning of simple organisms where it's all programmed. Okay, so that's one area. The other is the functioning of the individual. I don't know if you hear my dog barking in the background, do you? Yeah,
No.
I do. Okay, good. So if that and that's where Bowen defined it in the person, someone who is very extreme, almost utterly dependent on the emotional system around them to regulate them. To the individual who is autonomous and independent. And then you have it between people. You have relationship systems where there's more or less independence of functioning between the people in the relationship system, or more automatic reactivity, where everyone is regulating everyone else, that kind of thing. And that that continuum of functioning, guiding behavior in all these different domains just organizes a lot of the information. So it kind of goes beyond psychology. But psychology in particular, when I started to think about this, it's like a lot of the human disciplines like anthropology or sociology, but psychology has a lot of different sub-disciplines. So there's like physiological psychology, there's behavioral psychology, there's clinical psychology, there's perception, sensation and perception, there's emotion and motivation. And when I was reviewing sort of the discipline as a whole, there is not an integrative theory. Since I started this, evolutionary theory has come into scientific psychology in a big way. And that is integrating everything to where the science, which is significant and very respectable, much more so than when I began this, will always be having evolutionary theory as at its base. Bowen theory is another theory from evolutionary theory. It brings in a view of how the part and the whole relate to each other in all these living systems. And that it, once applied to various areas, I did a whole study on visual perception and the psychologist J.J. Gibson, who started to look at visual perception in terms of adaptation to the physical environment, and a totally different idea than the way the laboratory psychologists were trying to break down how does the sensation get into the brain, and then all these little pixel-like things come back together in a picture or something like that. You remove the organism from the environment and try and study what happens as opposed to trying to understand the organism in the environment. Ideas like that, which were consistent with Bowen theory. Anyway, it's kind of a big idea, which maybe I'll get back to it at some point, but that I did quite a few papers on it for a period of years when we were having conferences up here, and I presented a few of them back at the annual symposium at the Georgetown Family Center, now the Bowen Center.
I would love to read them. And I think evolutionary psychology has taken off. Bowen theory is a little different. It has evolutionary theory in it. But I love how you said it's about how the part relates to the whole. And then how does that so other realms, other the other maybe departments of psychology or ideas in psychology then kind of can fit into this model? Is that the idea?
Yeah, so during the course of my career, a new society formed, the Association for Psychological Science. It had been the American Psychological Association, which became dominated by clinical interests and kind of the guild practice interests, financial business things about being in the business of delivering clinical services came to have much more of a role in the organization and the national organization. So the scientists broke off. And this was, I think, in 1989. It was the same year I started programs in Bowen theory up here. And that has become huge. And they now have the premier scientific journals in psychology, and if you want to follow them, the best people publish there. And that's scientific psychology. So I forget your question. What was it?
Oh no, I think you answered it. It's just that I guess I was thinking about this part relating to the whole
Oh.
and how other ideas in psychology can be seen through this framework. It's
So.
I guess it's di what I'm thinking is it's different than a lot of ideas in psychology focus on what's happening in the individual. And this is what you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, what you're saying is this is about a much broader context than just the individual.
Yeah, but it also goes into what goes on in the individual. I mean, if you're looking at physiology, for instance, there's a difference in cause and effect thinking and systems thinking in terms of looking at the body holistically, or the body and brain even. So, I mean, so it goes all the way down to one of my favorite guest experts at the symposium was Jim Shapiro, James Shapiro, who studied, bacterial colonies at University of Chicago. Brilliant guy. Wrote a book called Genetics for the 21st Century, which, along with people like Barbara McClintock, took this genetic determinism out of cause and effect thinking into there is a complex system where the genes are not only regulating the organism, but the organism and the environment are feeding back into regulating the genome and its expression. Those were ideas. So that's at that level. And that, of course, genetics is a big part of psychology as well, behavioral genetics, sociobiology that E.O. Wilson came up with. So that might be one example,
It's a
but
great example. So not just seeing what happens in the individual as cause and effect, but as part of a complex system.
yeah, that every living system is a complex system, and to the extent that Bowen theory has got the sort of the basics of the human relationship system, if it's good enough, it'll go all the way down the phylum and into all the living systems and its subsystems, and the basic principles will hold.
Makes a lot of sense. I wanted to ask you about this idea of the societal concept in Bowen theory, especially given that my sense is we're living in very tense and a anxious times. How are you thinking about this?
Well, all over the place. I can't claim to, I am how I am actually thinking about it when I'm not just reacting to it.
Me too.
is that from the beginning of my contact with Bowen and his theory, this has been predicted. Right, we're just, if, but for a long time, it was off in the future. And now I'm completely clear we're in it. And there was a lot I never understood about it. Like he used to say things like, and it's written, this current societal regression began shortly after the Second World War. And I was, until recently, I did not have a way to think about it. It always kind of came up as a question in my thinking that kind of bugged me. What was he talking about? I mean, there was this post-war boom, everything was great. Everybody loved the 50s and 60s, the world order that came out of the Second World War led to unprecedented periods of peace and an orderly world that, anyway, that all kinds of great things happened, the civil rights movement, so, well, The one thing that Bowen anchored his concept in, most fundamentally, I think you can read it, anybody can read it and see if they agree with this, is that there is a response to the is what's happening to the natural environment, our place in the natural world, the earth. So now the climate wasn't a thing when he wrote this, but the environment was. I kind of laugh when I think about when I was in the early postgraduate, people were worried about what happens if we run out of oil, you know. And now the thing is like, God, we got to get control of the oil. So he saw the environmental crisis coming in that there was big changes, this awareness that he believed under lie, this is what he wrote up, the increasing societal anxiety of we cannot go on this way on spaceship Earth. And everybody is kind of feeling it. So I kind of had those ideas about it. And understood, like from studies, like Jack Calhoun, the rat man, who was a frequent presence at the symposium, and his work became important to a lot of us. He was at one of the meetings, and I was discussing on a panel that he was part of, and it was just so clear in what he was describing when animals become overwhelmed by population pressures, which is what happened in the rat colonies he was studying, how, you know, behavior breaks down, and it can happen pretty fast, you know, and it's sort of, I remember at that meeting realizing once it starts to happen, things can come apart pretty fast. And I think it was, and I think in sort of my way, I could get plaintive in certain times in those years. I go, so what are we supposed to do? And I remember Kathy Kerr got up in the audience and she said, well, at least you'll kind of know what's happening. You know, you'll kind of know what's going on. So that's kind of one answer. It's not that satisfying. It hasn't satisfied me in terms of wanting to know what one can do. And I think there's a lot of people trying to do things. And now what I'm wondering is it at a fundamental level, like the people practicing regenerative agriculture, for instance, are operating at this very fundamental level of the earth and the fact that, you know, a third of the earth is grasslands that's going to desert. And the stewards of the land, the ranchers and farmers, can be a huge force for good in the way they do agriculture, as opposed to the kind of industrial agriculture, which uses chemicals, fossil fuels to fertilize and transport, and just everything is all wrong. So I saw a statistic recently that in Montana, in I think it was 1970, they were producing 70% of their own food. Now it's 3%. And that's everywhere. We are all completely divorced from the land, dependent on these gigantic industrial systems that are being driven by short-term profit motive on the part of everybody concerned, and the problems. So that's just one area. I think it's a huge area. So, you know, I'm kind of looking really at people who are operating at that level, really at that fundamental level of the idea. So, I have come to really love this writer, Wendell Berry. I don't know if you know of him, but he has done, I think, a rather comprehensive critique of how this degeneration in agricultural systems and the human systems that tend to it have broken up community, and how that has broken up communities and impaired the development of character. And so I'm wondering about all of that with the idea in mind, if you have to go back and really have to change the way you produce food and everyone's relationship to it, that changes our relationships to one another in a way that maybe forces us to be more deeply aware of our interdependence and respectful of that. Something like that is where my thinking has been going.
Less disconnected from that process, and 'cause I'm more like you said, more aware of our dependence on the land, on each other,
Right.
has a impact on how we perceive ourselves, our relationship systems, and what we
Yeah.
do in them.
Yeah. And how we kind of are responsible to one another. So.
I've often thought that if I liked how you said fundamental. My thinking has always been the word local comes to mind. It's got to start. If you're going to do anything, it has to start locally and being responsible in some way for yourself where you're at.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, everybody does something where you're at, where they're at, but it's because there's sure, I think, no really big answers to this that I mean, there's a lot of different areas to work in, and you know, so everybody do their part.
I hear that. You know, I was thinking, the thing that's been on my mind and bothering me, maybe you're giving away, to move to do something about it. This is the idea in Bowen theory that when anxiety goes up, the togetherness pressures increase in some way in a family or in groups. And I that's the sense that I get now is collect as anxiety goes up, we everybody's going to their in group
Yeah.
because there's a comfort in it, safety in it, I guess. But it's at the expense of somebody else or another group.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, been a it's but you know, part of the survival mechanisms, I think, is, you know, we call it tribal or something. You know, the yeah, as you were talking about the anxiety and the just fueling the togetherness force, so people come together in their kind of tribal group, whatever it happened might be. But the kind of the polarization also comes out of that togetherness that somehow. I mean, and this is a complex story to tell, how the togetherness force and its pressure in groups eventually forces people apart and into conflict. with one another. But that's the thing where, Bowen's concept of what goes on at the societal level is this idea that man's problem is not so much with one another as it is with nature.
With nature, the nature of like the natural world
Yeah, I
or
mean,
nat
I've
human
thought
nature.
about that a lot. I think just that you can get so far by exploiting it, and then it bites you. And when that happens, the competition for resources, for instance, intensifies. Maybe that's one example. That's one of those enigmatic statements that I've kind of puzzled about a lot, but that's sort of maybe one view of it, one aspect of it. I mean, with the world at the population it's at, which may eventually start to decrease, not everybody's going to raise their own food. That's not going to happen. But how do you create a society where the governing of it keeps in good contact with the realistic ecology that the society is living in? That's one of its major functions. And so you have this kind of storage, this hoarding, this greed that goes on, where for whatever reason we're kind of programmed to be that way. And so you have this sort of extractive, exploitive relationship to the land and to other people. And eventually you run it down, now the soil is bare. Now what are you going to do? You're going to be able to think of something? Well, you're not going to be able to think of something in some of these instances. You're just going to be one of those civilizations that goes blank,
And as that happens, the anxiety goes up and people polarize in their groups.
Start to fight each other for territory, for resources, for dominance, all that stuff.
Well, it sounds like one way through it, as you said earlier, is maybe collectively taking responsibility for the relationship to how we do agriculture, being more connected to the land.
So, look at what you're buying at the grocery store. Where's your money going? When you buy your clothes, when you, I mean, all our economic decisions are a way in which all of us can participate in supporting things that support some progress as opposed to things that just sort of are piling on the problems.
I was thinking earlier today, does theory, Bowen theory, suggest maybe can one extract some kind of ethic from it? I don't know if you've ever had that question.
That's a wonderful question. I mean, I feel deeply that it does. One of the things he used to say about if there was a bias in the theory, it was towards the future generations. It prioritizes the children and their well-being and future generations. So, I mean, there's an ethic of responsibility to the future.
Sounds like a good bias.
So, yeah, and his point was, natural systems are going to do what natural systems do. They don't have that bias necessarily. Bowen theory is just an absolutely amazing creation or discovery.
Do you have is there a piece of wisdom you carry with you that's been useful to you over the years?
Oh, beyond what I've said, is there any more? Show up.
I love it. And show up. That's a good one. There's an old saying, for I grew up playing sports. It's like not 90% is just showing up.
I think that there is a lot to that. If if that's just maybe the only principle you're running on, you really live by it, you learn a lot.
Laura, I really appreciate your time and thoughtfulness. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Guillermo. It was a great conversation for me. Thank you.
Thank you.